Hello, everyone. I'm Kamran.
And I'm Billy. Welcome to the Horse Frog Podcast, home of your two favorite professional digressors.
Today, we will be discussing Book 4, Chapter 17 of Deadhouse Gates, a novel in the Malazan Book of the Fallen. This is part two of our coverage of this chapter.
This podcast series is intended to be a companion to reading or listening to the books in the Malazan universe. It's not a book review, and it's most definitely not intended to be a replacement to reading the books. Know that Kamran and I know that this series is the best fantasy story ever written, and we're approaching this from a purely fanboy point of view. There's not going to be any critique. We'll just continue marveling at Mr. Erickson's Light Endeavors series of books. Let's face it, Deadhouse Gates is Light Endeavors personified, is it not?
It most certainly is. We'll be covering the events of the books in a linear fashion. There will be spoilers for those that have not read the books. We'll try not to spoil anything prior to us covering that portion of the respective book.
And a quick warning, today's episode contains descriptions of extreme violence, and it's not recommended for children.
So would you say it's a TV 14? Or is it more of a TVMA rating?
Probably TVMA. It's like Daredevil. It's like Daredevil season one.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Our show is listener supported. If you'd like to support us, we'd really appreciate it. You can do so by visiting our Patreon link on our website at horsefrogproductions.com. Currently, we are posting ad-free episodes on Patreon weekly.
Also, we would really like to hear from you, so send any feedback or comments that you have to contact@horsefrogproductions.com.
All right, chapter 17, part two. We pick up on the Ragstopper. The squall was spent, and the sky to the east was brightening, clean and gold. Ragstopper had come around as the trade wind returned. The mess on the stern castle had been cleared away, and the crew looked to have things in hand, although Kalam could see their tension. The treasurer and his remaining bodyguard stood near the mainmast, the former staring steadily at the raider, keeping pace to starboard, close enough to see figures on its deck, watching them in turn. The bodyguard's attention, however, was on Sulk Elan, lounging near the forecastle steps. None of the crew seemed willing to cut across the 10 paces separating the two men. A standoff, if you will.
Is this a Malazan standoff?
Yes, sir. Most definitely. Kalam made his way to the treasurer's side. He asked, "You have taken command then?" The man nodded sharply, his diffidence obvious as he avoided Kalam's eye. He said, "I intend to buy our way clear." Kalam said, "Take your cut, you mean. And how much would that be? 80%, 90%? With you along as hostage, of course." He watched the blood leave the man's face. The treasurer said, "This is not your concern." Kalam said, "You're right, but killing the captain and his officers is, because it jeopardizes this voyage. If the crew doesn't know for certain, you can rest assured it suspects." The treasurer said, "We have the Marines to deal with that. Back away and you'll survive intact. Step in and you'll be cut down." Kalam studied the raider. He asked, "And what's their percentage? What's to stop them from slitting your throat and sailing off with the whole share?" The treasurer smiled and said, "I doubt my uncle and cousins would do that. Now, I suggest you go below, back to your cabin, and stay there." Ignoring the advice, Kalam went off to find the Marines. And what a snake this guy is. He's a treasurer, and he's related to a bunch of pirates. They've probably been smuggling for Pormqual all this time.
Yeah. And my thing is, do you think Pormqual knows about this? I think something we said last episode may have implied that it was strictly the treasurer, but if this has got Pormqual's signature on it or his seal versus the Imperial seal on it, he wants this stuff. I could see him arranging this too to try and keep this money for himself or keep some of this money for himself.
I think this is the treasurer going off on his own with his contacts. So Pormqual is a snake. This guy's crooked too. Pormqual thinks he can trust this guy to get his stuff away from Seven Cities. Come to find out, this guy's just going to disappear with it.
Right. Okay.
He may not even think Pormqual can get out of Seven Cities. Maybe he thinks, I'll get away scot-free. Nobody's going to come looking for this.
I could see that too. I could definitely see that.
The engagement with the pirates had been fierce and short. Not only was the ship coming apart under them, but there was little fight left in the raiders' panicked crew. The lieutenant muttered, "More like a slaughter," as Kalam crouched down opposite her. The two squads sat in the forward hold, amidst streams of water running down the planks, busy stuffing rags into the breaches in the hull. The captain was not lying about having enough rags on hand to stop all this damage.
We had assumed the name was well-earned. Remember when Kalam first got on board, when we first came to the Ragstopper, I was like, I think he was under decks, and it was like there wasn't a dry spot on the lower decks. Or something like that. It's like, wow, we're not even out of the dock yet.
Yeah, they had a 3-man crew pumping.
Yes, yeah. Now that's where they even left. You're like, wait, we're just sitting here at the dock.
The lieutenant said, "We didn't even take a scratch." Kalam quietly asked, "What have you worked out thus far?" She shrugged and said, "As much as we need to, Corporal. What do you want us to do?" Kalam said, "The treasurer will order you to stand down. The pirates will then relieve you of your weapons." The lieutenant said, "At which point they slit our throats and toss us overside. Imperial writ or no, the man's committing treason." Kalam rose and said, "Well, he's stealing from a thief, but I take your point. I'll talk with the crew and get back to you, Lieutenant." She asked, "Why don't we take down the treasurer and his bodyguard right now, Kalam?" Kalam's eyes narrowed. He said, "Stick to the rules, Lieutenant. Leave murder to those whose souls are already stained." And this was one of those quotes that I had highlighted from a prior read-through. It's coming back again on that point of how Kalam views himself. I think this is the second time he said his soul is stained, isn't it?
Yes, at minimum the second time. I think he may have said it at least once before. But yeah, that's a good quote. No, I did not have it highlighted, though. I like when sometimes we do have some things highlighted together. That's nice, but we didn't this time.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on this sentiment from Kalam? Is this a noble act from him to spare the Marines the guilt of killing somebody not in a battle scenario?
I believe so. Because that is the, at least my perception of, that is a gift maybe of being a soldier and being in battle, is that you're protected from that kind of type of conscious thing because you're fighting for your life versus killing someone unawares to make sure you get them. I think it's very much so, a very noble on Kalam's part.
I agree. The lieutenant bit her lip, studied him for a long time, then slowly nodded. Kalam found the sailor he'd spoken with when the hold was being loaded at the Aran Pier. The man was coiling ropes on the stern castle with the air of someone needing to keep busy. The sailor said, "Heard you saved the captain." Kalam said, "He's alive, but in bad shape." The sailor said, "Aye, cook standing outside his cabin door, sir. Wit a cleaver, and ask any hog, the man can use it. Beru's blessing. I seen the man shave wit it once, as clean as a virgin's tit." I think my grandpa used to have a saying, as cold as a witch's titty or something along those lines.
I've heard that. I've also heard that added inside of a brass brassiere.
Kalam asked, "Who is standing in for the officers?" The sailor said, "If you mean who's got things shipshape and all the hands at stations, that'd be me, sir. Only our new commander ain't much interested in jawing with me. His swordsman's come over to tell me to get ready to heave to once the seas have settled some." Kalam said, "To transfer cargo." The man nodded. Kalam asked, "And then?" The sailor said, "Well now, if the commander's true to his word, they'll let us go." Kalam grunted, "And why would they be so kind?" The sailor said, "Aye, I've been chewing on that one myself. We got sharp enough eyes, too sharp for them to breathe easy. Besides, there's what's been done to Captain. Got us a little peeved, that has." Boots thumped midships, and the two men turned to see the bodyguard lead the Marines onto the main deck. The lieutenant was looking none too happy. The sailor muttered, "It's the gods puke all round us now, sir. Raiders closing." Under his breath, Kalam said, "So we've arrived." He looked across to Sulk Elan and found the man's eyes on him. Kalam gave a nod, and Elan casually turned away, his hands hidden beneath his cloak. The sailor said, "That raider's got a shipload of swords, sir. I make 50 or more, all getting ready." Kalam said, "Leave them to the Marines. Your crew stays back. Spread the word." The sailor moved off. Kalam made his way to the main deck. The treasurer was facing off with the lieutenant. The treasurer snapped, "I said to surrender your weapons, lieutenant!" The lieutenant said, "No, sir, we will not." The treasurer was trembling with rage. He gestured to his bodyguard. The big tribesman did not get very far. He made a choking sound, hands reaching up to claw at the knife protruding from his throat. Then he fell to his knees, toppled. Sulky Land stepped forward and said, "Change of plans, my dear sir," as he bent to retrieve his knife. Kalam moved behind the treasurer and pushed the point of his long knife against the man's lower back. He growled, "Not a word, not a move." He then turned to the Marines and said, "Lieutenant, prepare to repel boarders." She said, "Aye, sir." She's saying sir to him. She outranks him.
Well, so he's taking command of the situation. What do you want?
He is a contextual alpha in this case.
I agree.
The raider was coming alongside, the pirates jostling as they prepared to leap the distance between the ships. The difference in height meant that they had a climb to make, nor could those on deck see much of what awaited them on Ragstopper. A lone crewman on the raider had begun a lazy climb toward the lone mast's tiny crow's nest. Kalam thought, too late, you fools. The pirate captain, the treasurer's uncle, Kalam assumed, shouted a greeting across the distance. Kalam growled, say hello. Who knows, if your cousins are good enough, you might win the day yet. The treasurer raised a hand, called out his answer. There was less than 10 paces between the two ships now. Sulk Elan approached those of the Ragstopper's crew who stood near the Marines. He said, when she's close enough, use the grappling hooks. Make sure we're snug, lads, because if she gets away, she'll hound us from here to Falar. The pirate climbing the mast was halfway up, already swinging around to see if he could get a better look at the scene on Ragstopper's main deck. The raider's crew threw lines across. The ships closed. A cry of warning from the lookout was cut short by a crossbow quarrel. The man toppled, landing amidst his fellows crowding the raider's deck. Angry shouts arose. Kalam gripped the treasurer by the collar and dragged him back as the first of the pirates leapt the distance and swarmed up Ragstopper's flank. The treasurer hissed, "You've made a terrible mistake." The Marines answered the assault with a murderous flight of quarrels. The first line of pirates pitched back. Those Malazan tactics again.
I just love that discipline. You know, you'd think I was more disciplined to myself due to my admiration of the military in this series and also in the real world, but I'm not. I have a modicum of discipline.
It's never too late to start, Billy.
It's true. I'm working. I'm more disciplined than I used to be, so my discipline is growing. So,
yeah, the important thing is, are you better than yesterday?
Probably not yesterday, but the day before maybe.
Okay. Two steps forward, one step back. Okay. Yes. At least it's a positive.
Yeah, positive loss. I'm just kidding.
Sulky Lance shouted a warning that brought Kalam spinning around. Hovering just off the port side, directly behind the grouped Marines, an apparition took form. Its wings 10 paces across, its shimmering scales bright yellow and blinding in the new day's light. The long reptilian head was a mass of fangs. Kalam thought, an Enkarl, this far from Uraku, hood's breath. The treasurer laughed, I warned you! The creature was a blur as it plunged into the midst of the Marines, talons crunching through chain and helms. Kalam whirled again, drove his fist into the grinning treasurer's face. The man dropped to the deck unconscious, blood gushing from his nose and eyes. Elan shouted, Kalam, leave the mage to me. Help the Marines. Kalam bolted forward. Enkarl were mortal enough, just notoriously hard to kill, and rare even in their desert home. Kalam had never before faced one. 7 Marines were down. The creature's wings thundered as it hung over the rest, its 2 taloned limbs darting downward, clashing against shields. What does this thing look like to you?
I don't know. I post a picture down here for you to see. That's from the Malazan Wiki. I'm sorry, I cheated. In my mind, I think it's kind of almost like a crocodile that's more upright with wings. I just wasn't sure if he's four-armed, you know, like four legs and 2 wings, or if it was like this picture shows, where in place of upper arms, it's 2 wings. So almost like
a vivern.
Yeah, almost like that. Kind of in that. I was going to say they were kind of draconic or part of that family. It looked almost in this picture here. Mm. But yeah, I'm imagining something very lizard-like, of course. And of course, it being the desert regions too, so I would assume that. But I don't know what else other than the wings.
Okay. For me, it's always been vaguely pterodactyl-like.
Oh, okay.
But
I get that.
More reptilian, not quite to the alligator level. Maybe right. If it had a real long, narrow snout. Maybe a caiman? I think they have a pretty long, narrow snout.
Yeah.
So not as wide as an alligator or crocodile.
Okay.
But definitely pterodactyl-like in build.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, I can't remember what movie. There's some movies that have some. It's science fiction movies that, of course, do this. I can't remember if it's that have these. I could see something in my mind that punching down with its wings, trying to use like the claws at the end of it. You know, because it even mentions that, I think, coming up here, how it's using its wing arms to bat at or try and puncture with something. So it's got some kind of claw on that there somewhere.
Yeah. Pirates were streaming onto Ragstopper, opposed now only by 6 Marines, the lieutenant among them. Kalam had little time to think of what he planned, and none to gauge Sulky Land's progress. He bellowed, "Stiffen shields!" then leapt forward, scrambling onto the shields. The Enkarl twisted around, razor claws lashing at his face. He ducked and drove his long knife up between the creature's legs. The point jammed against scale, snapping like a twig. He cursed, "Hood!" Dropping the weapon, Kalam surged upward, clambered over the gnarled, scaly hide. Jaws snapped down at him, but could not reach. Kalam swung around onto the beast's back. Sorceress concussions reached his ears from the raider's deck. Thrusting knife in one hand, his other arm looped around the Inkarl's sinuous neck, Kalam began slashing at the beating wings. The blade slipped through membrane, opening wide, spreading gaps. The Inkarl fell to the deck, into the midst of the surviving marines, who closed in around it, thrusting with their short swords. The heavier weapons succeeded where long knife failed, driving between scales. Blood sprayed. The creature screamed, thrashing about in its death throes. There was fighting on all sides now, as pirates converged to cut down the last of the marines. Kalam clambered off the dying Inkarl, shifted the knife to his left hand, and found a short sword lying beside a dead marine, barely in time to meet the charge of two pirates, their heavy scimitars slashing down on both sides. Kalam leapt between the two men, inside their reach, stabbed swiftly with both weapons, then pushed past, twisting his blades as he dragged them free. His awareness blurred then, as Kalam surged through a crush of pirates, cutting, slashing, and stabbing on all sides. He lost his knife as it jammed between ribs, used the freed hand to yank a helmet away from a collapsing warrior and jam it onto his head. The skull cap was too small, and a glancing blow from a wailing scimitar sent it flying even as he broke through the press, skidding on blood-slick decking as he spun around. Half a dozen pirates wheeled to attack him. Sulkyland struck the group from the side, a long knife in either hand. Three pirates went down in the first attack. Kalam launched himself forward, batting aside a blade, then driving stiff fingers into the wielder's throat. A moment later, the clash of weapons had ceased. Figures were sprawled on all sides, some moaning, some shrieking and gibbering in pain, but most still and silent. Kalam dropped to one knee, struggling to regain his breath. Elan muttered, "What a mess," as he crouched to wipe his blades clean. Kalam lifted his head and stared at him. Elan's fine clothes were scorched and soaked in blood. Half his face was bright red, flash burned, the eyebrow on that side a smear of ash. He was breathing heavily, and every breath caused him obvious pain. Wow, he really took a beating, taking out that mage.
Yes, and it's kind of makes me like him. You know, kind of got my respect a little bit. If not like, at least grudging respect. There we go. Isn't that grudging respect for the man?
Yeah, they fought together, and if it wasn't for the two of them, this would have been a whole different scenario.
That's true, but I won't trust him until Kalam does.
Good point. Kalam looked past the man. Not a single marine was standing. A handful of sailors moved among the bodies, pulling free those that still lived. They'd found but two thus far. Neither one the lieutenant. The acting first mate came to Kalam's side and said, "Cook wants to know." Kalam said, "What?" The first mate asked, "Is that big lizard tasty?" Salkyland's laugh became a cough. Kalam muttered, "A delicacy. 100 jacatas a pound in Panpotsin." That sounds pretty expensive.
Yeah, a lot like gator. So is this guy like a, is he a Cajun fella? Come walking, is that big lizard tasty?
Well, they'd find a way to eat it, that's for sure.
Well, he's not saying it's tasty. He's just saying it's worth 100 jacatas. It's delicacy, but
you'd have to think it's tasty if they're charging that much for it.
Sometimes rarity will make the, just make the cost high, even if it's not real good.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not a guy that pay that much for food. That's my problem.
The sailor went on. "Permission to cross over to the raider, sir. We can resupply." Kalam nodded. Elan said, "I'll go with you." The first mate said, "Appreciate that, sir." One of the sailors called, "Hey, what should we do with the treasurer? The bastard's still alive." Kalam said, "Leave him to me." The treasurer was conscious as they loaded him down with sacks of coin, making noises behind his gag, his eyes wide. Kalam and Sulkyland carried the man between them to the side and pitched him over without ceremony. Sharks converged on the splash the man made, but the effort of following him down proved too great for the already sated creatures. The stripped-down raider was still burning beneath a column of smoke as it vanished beyond the horizon. Cold-blooded.
Yes, and this is a very core memory for me, is I can just see that fellow sinking down right now in my mind. I'm like, oh, wow.
Oof. Well-deserved. All those people died for his greed.
Yes, it's well-deserved.
We go to Felicin and Company. The whirlwind lifted itself in a towering wall, higher than the eye could fathom, and over a mile in width, around the holy desert Raraku. Within the wasteland's heart, all remained calm. Battered ridges of bedrock rose above the sands ahead. Walking half a dozen paces in front, Leoman paused and turned. He said, "We must cross a place of spirits." Felicin nodded and said, "Older than this desert. They have risen and now watch us." The Toblakai asked, "Do they mean us harm, Shaikh Reborn?" as he reached for his weapon. She said, "No, they may be curious, but they are beyond caring." She turned to Hebrick, who was still huddled within himself. She asked, "What do you sense?" He flinched away from her voice. He muttered, "One needn't be an immortal ghost not to care." She studied him, then said, "Fleeing from the joy of being reborn cannot last, Hebrick. What you fear is becoming human once again." He gave a bitter laugh. She said, "You do not expect to hear such things from me. For all that you disliked what I was, you are loath to relinquish that child." Hebrick said, "You're still in that rush of power, Felicin, and it's deluded you into thinking it's delivered wisdom as well. There are gifts, and then there is that which must be earned."
Nicely stated.
Yeah. The Toblakai growled, "He is as shackles about you, Shaikh Reborn. Kill him." Is he a little salty about getting absolutely wrecked by Hebrick?
Well, he wanted to kill him as it was. I mean, when she gave him permission to kill him, I mean, he already had his sword in his hand. I mean, he's had one sword in his hand ready to kill that dude since he laid eyes on him.
Yeah.
And all I had to say is, yeah, I think that's made him saltier. But notice, he's stuck to his word. He's not addressing Hebrick personally. He's at least, he's referring to Hebrick around him, but he's not speaking to him personally. So
yes,
he's
not speaking to him.
He could speak. His vow's not broken. He could have spoke to him to try and kill him, and he failed to kill him, which is,
I think it still holds, probably. He's just not going to talk to him.
Me and you both know when this guy makes up his mind. This is the birth of a guy making up his mind right here.
Felicin shook her head, still eyeing Hebrick. She said, "Since wisdom cannot be gifted to me, I would be gifted a wise man, his company, his words." Hebrick looked up at that, eyes narrowing beneath the heavy shelf of his brow. He said, "I thought you'd left me no choice, Felicin." Felicin said, "Perhaps it only seemed that way, Hebrick." She watched the struggle within him, the struggle that had always been there. She thought, "We have crossed a war-ravaged land, and all the while we were warring with ourselves. Drizna has but raised a mirror." She said, "I have learned one thing from you, Hebrick." Hebrick asked, "And that is?" She said, "Patience," then turned about and waved Leoman on. They approached the folded, scarred outcroppings. There was little evidence that this place had once known sacred rites. The basaltic bedrock was impervious to the usual pitting and grooving that active hands often worked into the stone of holy sites, nor was there any pattern in the few boulders scattered about. Yet Felicin could sense the presence of spirits, once strong, now but echoes, and their faint regard followed them with unseen eyes. Beyond the rise, the desert swept out and down into an immense basin, where the dwindling sea of ancient times had finally died. Suspended dust cloaked the vast depression. At her side, Leoman said, "The oasis lies near the center." She nodded. Leoman went on, "Less than 7 leagues now." Felicin asked, "Who carries Shaikh's belongings?" Leoman said, "I do." She said, "I will take them." He was silent as he set down his pack, untied the flap, and began removing items. Clothing, a scatter of a poor woman's rings, bracelets, and earrings, a thin-bladed long knife, its iron stained black except for the honed edge.
You know, I don't know why I always get, anytime we get to this scene, I always get this Dune vibe for some reason. It's desert. Mm-hmm. Rather desert. Knives coming out, you know.
It's like a Chris knife.
Yeah, I got the knives and the rings. I'm like, oh, okay. I get these Dune vibes, you know, especially with, because I'm getting excited for Dune Part 2.
Yeah. So you haven't seen it yet?
No. We're going to watch it here. We were going to watch it tonight, but I figured we'd wait till tomorrow. She'll have, we screwed her. Oh, we watched that movie. Have you heard of Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage?
No.
It's kind of a Malkovich. It's like a John Malkovich, being John Malkovich kind of type movie. This guy he's a real plain kind of guy, real boring. He's a professor, and people start dreaming about him. He's showing up in their dreams. He's not doing anything. He's just kind of hanging out, and he becomes viral, and he starts becoming bigger and bigger and weird, and then he starts becoming a victim of cancel culture because things happen to him in life, and apparently in the dreams, the dreams start taking a darker turn for everyone who sees him in their dreams. So it's really, it's a comedy, or it's on Max. If you've got that, it's one of the Blumhouse group or A24 lot. I forget, but it's kind of like a thematic twin to being John Malkovich in some weird way to me. Very entertaining though. I think you get a kick out of it. Some of it's hilarious. Some of it's like, huh? There's some uncomfortableness to it, but it's just watch the whole thing. But you just got to watch the whole thing though. Kind of deal.
Okay. Now,
but give it a shot, I say.
We'll see.
Yeah. I know
you've got, we'll add it to the list.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. I was going to say, we live in the era of there's just too much. There's yes. I'm never going to see everything I want to see. I'm committed to that. I'm okay with that. You know, it's like, I want to be distracted at the moment kind of deal. I don't care what it is. So
I have the added complication of having to have the kids be asleep to watch anything that's adult oriented. And
yeah.
At that point, I'm going to bed myself, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah. Leoman said, "Her sword awaits us at the encampment. She wore the bracelets on her left wrist only, the rings on her left hand." He gestured down at some leather straps. "She wound these around her right wrist and forearm." He paused, looked up at her with hard eyes, then said, "It were best you match the attire, precisely." She smiled and said, "To aid in the deceit, Leoman?" He dropped his gaze and said, "There may well be some resistance. The high mages," she interrupted, "would bend the cause to their wills, create factions within the camp, then clash in a struggle to decide who will rule all. They have not yet done so, for they cannot determine if Shaik still lives. Yet they have prepared the ground." Leoman said, "Seer." Felicin said, "Ah, you accept that much at least." Leoman bowed and said, "None could deny the power that has come to you, yet." Felicin said, "Yet I did not myself open the holy book." Leoman met her eyes and said, "You did not." Felicin looked up. The Toblachai and Hebrick stood a short distance away, watching, listening. She said, "What I shall open is not between those covers, but is within me. Now is not the time." She faced Leoman again and said, "You must trust in me." The skin tightened around Leoman's eyes. Felicin said, "You never could easily yield that, could you, Leoman?" Leoman asked, "Who speaks?" Felicin said, "We do." Leoman was silent. Felicin said, "Toblachai." He said, "Yes, Shaik Reborn." She asked, "To a man who doubts you, you would use what?" He replied, "My sword." Witness.
Success.
Hebrick snorted. Felicin swung to Hebrick and asked, "And you, what would you use?" Hebrick said, "Nothing. I would be as I am, and if I prove worthy of trust, that man will come to it." She asked, "Unless?" Hebrick scowled and said, "Unless that man cannot trust himself, Felicin." She turned back to Leoman and waited. Hebrick cleared his throat and said, "You cannot command someone to have faith, lass. Obedience, yes, but not belief itself." And he speaks the truth.
The saying, "Truer words have never been spoken," come to mind to that.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. She said to Leoman, "You told me there is a man to the south, a man leading a battered remnant of an army and refugees numbering tens of thousands. They do as he bids. Their trust is absolute. How has that man managed that?" Leoman shook his head. She asked, "Have you ever followed such a leader, Leoman?" Leoman said, "No." She said, "So you truly do not know?" Leoman said, "I do not know, seer." Dismissive of the eyes of three men, Felicin stripped down and attired herself in Shaik's clothing and jewelry with an odd sense of long familiarity, then tossed aside the rags she had been wearing earlier. She studied the desert basin for a long moment, then said, "Come, the high mages have begun to lose their patience." I know she's not trying to compare herself to Coltane.
I would hope not. You know, she doesn't know enough about Coltane, because if she did, it would be kind of like, are you aware of, did we mention this last episode? I can't remember, about Jake Paul going to fight Mike Tyson.
We haven't talked about this, no.
Okay. And I've heard some talk about, I listened to Joe Rogan talking about this, saying that, you know, and not to sell Jake Paul short, you know, he's actually, Rogan thinks he's actually a fairly decent fighter. He goes, but when he sees Mike Tyson come bobbing and weaving out of that corner, looking as fast as he's ever looked, that's going to be his come to moment. Like that's really Mike Tyson. That's what I'm comparing this to. If she's comparing herself to that man, that would be like that. It'd be like Jake Paul stepping up to Mike Tyson.
I view it a little bit differently. I think the Paul brothers are exceedingly good at marketing. So I don't know if there's some ulterior motive going on here where it's kind of fixed on who's going to win potentially. I don't think Jake Paul's going to go all out. You know, he's in his prime, and Mike Tyson, while he once was extremely strong, and he's probably still very strong compared to most people, he's like 58 or something.
57.
And
he's 57. That this is true, but this is Joe Rogan. Joe knows what he's talking about. At least,
yeah. I'm just saying. To me, it's a little bit different from the perspective that Jake Paul has been in several fights, and he's been training really hard. Felicin has done literally nothing with her entire life of value. She has provided no value at all.
She's walked across the desert. That's all she's done.
She was dragged across the desert.
That's true. She's only.
I can't even give her the credit of doing anything herself.
No, because even this is not her. Even what she's doing here is not her. You know what I'm saying? It's like somebody. Yeah. It's something driving her.
True. It's like a merging of the two, almost.
Yes, yes. So we are having a Shaikh reborn kind of thing going on here. And Felicin, again, is just all she needed to do is show up and be the vessel. That's it.
Right.
You're correct. She provided no value. She's the ring. She's the ring in The Hobbit. You know what I'm talking about. That's all the purpose is finding the ring. And so she... Here we are. She's the vessel.
I'm curious what's going to happen with that fight, though.
Me too. I don't usually care about that kind of stuff, but I'm curious because I don't know much about Paul. The only reason it came to my attention is because I sometimes find myself down that deep dive of YouTube, and I've watched him mock Tyson to some extent, and I don't know if that's planned and with Tyson's consent or if he's making Psycho Mike mad with this mocking, and if that's the case... He might get berserker, Mike. I don't know.
Mike Tyson seems pretty chill nowadays, though.
He does. I think he's found himself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's found himself.
I can tell you though, from a personal perspective, these guys that are in their prime, in their 20s, mm-hmm. and that work out a lot all the time, man, they're tough to deal with when you start. So I'm like 42, almost 43. You know, and this is like in jiu-jitsu. Man, it's tough keeping up with those guys.
Do you see who Tyson has been showing? He's working with some guy who is a UFC guy who is like, I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, but it's what I'm saying is it's not a matter of who you're working with.
Right.
It's a matter of your reserves and what you can actually deal with.
Tyson is one that if he don't take you out fast – that's always, I think, been his downfall, isn't it? I think the only time he loses is if it goes any further, if it goes longer, right? Is that what happens to him?
I am not a student of his fighting style. He used to knock people out pretty quick. I remember some people telling stories about their dad going to the other room to get a beer for their friends, and then he comes back, and the fight's already over, and he missed the whole fight.
I'll give you my experience. The only time I've actually been to a pay-per-view fight, this is when I was hanging out this is after Cowboys from Hell. So I was hanging out with Philip Ensemble, the singer from Pantera. We were a side band with Philip. So we were hanging out at his house, and this was one of these fights. I forget who he was fighting. It's one of the Holyfield fights, I think. You know, you spend 2 hours getting ready for this. You know, they've got the preview. He's got this Spike Lee documentary about Mike and stuff before this, you know, it's 2 hours of all this prep and all this time. Phil has another friend because Phil's a boxing student. He's a good boxer himself, actually. So this buddy of his who he boxes with and is his running buddy that they hang out all the time and is coming over, and he's got money on the other guy, whoever it is. And so, you know, fight starts 3 seconds, 10 seconds, 12. I forget how fast it is. Basically, however long it takes Tyson to cross the ring, he lays the guy out.
Wow.
This flats out. And we're just like, yeah. It was like, wow, that was all the lead up to it was so much more longer. It's like, it was kind of anticlimactic, you know, it's very anticlimactic. And so this guy hadn't shown up yet. And so we're like, so Phil puts us up to this. He's okay. Look. Steve's pulling up in the parking lot now. So everyone look all down. Like I'm mad and I've been mad. So I act like I've been really pissed off. Like Tyson has lost. And so this guy, Steve, walks in and he sees us all kind of looking kind of like, we all wanted Tyson to win and he lost. And yeah, he says, I've got it saved for you. And he rolls it back and shows it. And we all just like, got, you know, as soon as it's, like I said, it takes about 30 seconds to do it. Mm-hmm. Then it goes over and we're like, ah, that's, so that's, that was my experience of watching a pay-per-view Mike Tyson fight. So
sounds about the same, right?
Exactly. If you blinked, you missed it. Uh-huh. And that's quite literally. It's to say it was that quick.
Yeah. I mean, explosiveness, speed, they go out the window as you age. So yeah. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see. We'll see. Yeah.
Moving along. We go back to the rag stopper. Kalam said, we're only a few days from Falar, according to the first mate. Everyone's talking about these trade winds. The captain growled, I bet they are. He looked as if he'd swallowed something sour. Kalam refilled their tankards and leaned back. Whatever still afflicted the captain, keeping him to his cot for days now, went beyond the injuries he'd sustained at the hands of the bodyguard. He thought, mind you, head wounds can get complicated. Even so. The captain trembled when he spoke, though his speech was in no way slurred or otherwise impaired. The struggle seemed to be in pushing the words out, in linking them into anything resembling a sentence. Yet in his eyes, Kalam saw a mind no less sharp than it had been. Kalam was baffled, yet he felt on some instinctive level that his presence gave strength to the captain's efforts. He said, look outside of the ship in our wake just before sunset yesterday. A Malazan fast trader, he thinks. If it was, it must have passed us without lights or hail in the night. No sign of it this morning. The captain grunted. Never made better time. Bet their eyes are wide, too, dropping headless cocks over the starboard side into Beru's smiling maw at every blessed bell. Beru is also known as the god of storms, so that would kind of make sense. Oh, doing Beru ritual, a ritual sacrifice to have the tailwinds at their back or something.
Yeah.
Kalam took a mouthful of watered wine, studying the captain over the tankard's dented rim. He said, we lost the last two Marines last night. Left me wondering about that ship's healer of yours. The captain said, been having a run of the Lord's push he has, not like him. Kalam said, well, he's passed out on pirate's ale now. The captain said, doesn't drink. Kalam noted, he does now. The look the captain gave him was like a bright, distant flare, a beacon warning of shoals ahead. Kalam quietly rumbled, all's not well, I take it. The captain said, captain's head's askew, that's a fact, tongue full of thorns, close by ears like acorns under the mulch, ready to hatch unseen, hatch. That sentence right there. What does that even mean?
I know. At first you're like, okay, he's right, his head's askew. Mm-hmm. And his tongue is full of thorns.
Yeah.
In a way, yes. Okay. I got that.
The rest of it, not so sure.
Not sure, yeah. Buddy.
Kalam said, you'd tell me if you could. The captain said, tell you what? Can't hold what's not there, I always say. Can't hold in a blow neither. Lo, the acorns rolled away, plumb away. Kalam said, your hands look well enough mended. The captain said, aye, well enough, then looked away, as if the effort of conversation had finally become too much. Kalam hesitated, then said, I've heard of a Warren. And he's, again, thinking about Makra.
Yeah.
I suspect.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
The captain muttered, rabbits. Rats. Kalam rose and sighed. All right, we'll find you a proper healer, a Dunul healer, when we get to Falar. The captain said, getting there fast. Kalam said, aye, we are. The captain said, on the trade winds. Kalam said, aye. The captain said, but there aren't any trade winds this close to Falar. That's suspicious.
Yeah. And see, the captain, that's where these things come up. And you're like, he seems to pop up here once in a while where he comes back into focus. Like,
yeah.
Is that him or is that still another one of these weird? He's obviously trying to say something.
Definitely. Kalam emerged onto the deck, held his face to the sky for a moment, then made his way to the forecastle. Elan asked, how does he fare? Kalam said, poorly. Elan said, head injuries are like that. Get knocked wrong and you end up muttering marriage vows to your lapdog.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Kalam said, we'll see in Falar. Elan said, we'd be lucky to find a good healer in Bantra. Kalam said, Bantra? Hood's breath, why Bantra when the main islands are but a few leagues farther along? Elan shrugged and said, Ragstopper's home birth, it seems. in case you haven't noticed, our acting first mate lives in a tangle of superstition. He's a legion of neurotic sailors all rolled up in one, Kalam. And on this one, you won't sway him. Hood knows I've tried. A shot from the lookout interrupted their conversation. Sails! 2 pegs off the port bow! 6, 7, 10! Beru's blessing! A fleet! Kalam and Elan stepped over to the forecastle's port side rail. As yet, they could see nothing but waves. The first mate called up from the main deck. What's their bearing, Vol? Vol said, North, sir, and westerly. They'll cut across our wake, sir. Elan muttered, in about 12 hours, hard tacking all the way. Kalam said, a fleet. Elan said, Imperial, the adjunct Tavora, friend. If you thought the blood had run thick enough over your homeland, well, thank the gods we're heading the other way. They could see the first sails now, Kalam thought, Tavora's fleet. Horse and troop transports, the usual league-long wake of garbage, sewage and corpses, human and animal. The sharks and Denrabi thrashing the waves. Any long journey by sea delivers an army foul of temper and eager to get to business. No doubt enough tales of atrocities have reached them to scorch mercy from their souls.
You know, this is what's kind of cool here. This is where some stories physically cross each other's paths.
Yeah, and it also helps set some timelines in order.
Yeah, it does. Well, I was thinking about it. Did you ever see, oh my good gracious, it's one of the Top Gun movies. And it's got, you know, Charlie Sheen. And there's a scene on a river where Charlie is floating down river and he's got the head talk going. And then you hear Martin Sheen from Apocalypse Now.
Oh, this is Hot Shots?
Hot Shots. That's what it is. Okay, Hot Shots.
Okay.
And I'm reminded of that because it's like, I love that they pop up and they're both, it's like, oh, that's exactly what it is. They've crossed paths. And it happens also in Scream 3, I think, with Jay and Silent Bob crossing paths with something. Jay and Silent Bob crossed paths with Scream 3. And Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yeah, I don't remember that part.
Well, remember, they actually go into one of the Scream sets.
Mm, okay.
And as they're coming out, we don't see what happens. But in Scream 3, you see them meet up with Courtney Cox in the Scream movie. And they give her a hard time and call her Connie Chung. She looks, it's that Connie Chung woman, you know, saying the B word, but not the woman. But so it's kind of funny how a couple of movies, this is what I think of, is like these, they're kind of crossing right here. It's like, oh, wow, I forgot they meet up right here.
Elan quietly said, the serpent's head on that long, stretching imperial neck. Tell me, Kalam, is there a part of you, an old soldier's, longing to be standing on a deck over there, noting with scant interest a lone, Falar-bound trader ship, while deep within you builds that quiet, deadly determination? On your way to deliver Lassine's punishment, what she's always delivered, as an empress must, a vengeance tenfold. Are you tugged between two tides right now, Kalam? Kalam said, my thoughts are not yours to pillage, Elan, no matter how rampant your imagination. You do not know me, nor shall you ever know me. Elan sighed. We've fought side by side, Kalam. We proved ourselves a deadly team. Our mutual friend in Erlitan had suspicions of what you intend. Think of how much greater your chances with me at your side. Kalam slowly turned to face Elan. He asked, chances of what? Elan's shrug was easy, careless. He said, whatever. You're not averse to partnerships, are you? There was Quick Ben, and before that, Porthal Canastra from your early pre-imperial days in Karashimesh. Hood knows, anyone looking at your history, Kalam, might well assert that you thrive on partnerships. Well, man, what do you say? Kalam responded with a slow blink of his lids. He said, and what makes you think I am alone right now, Sulky Land?
Nice.
For the briefest yet most satisfying of moments, Kalam saw a flicker of uncertainty rattle Elan's face before a smooth smile appeared. He said, and where does he hide? Up in the crow's nest with that dubiously named lookout? Kalam turned away and said, where else? Kalam felt Salk Elan's eyes on his back as he strode away. He thought, you've the arrogance common to every mage, friend. You'll have to excuse my pleasure in spreading cracks through it. And thus the chapter ends.
Good chapter.
Yeah, it was. I just noticed that Elan called the dubiously named lookout. The name was Vol.
Yeah.
He actually said something about it. That's funny.
That is funny, dude. Mm.
All right, for standout moments, Kalam fighting the Inkar All And I mean, really, that whole battle scene was really, really cool.
Absolutely. That's like some of the most, I could see that one almost in a blow by blow kind of situation. That was felt really, that was a very visceral feeling fight. It was quick, but it was a lot going on. It was awesome.
Yeah. And Sulky Land and Kalam tearing up that large group of pirates together. That was really cool.
Yes.
The amount of battling in this chapter, it was a significant portion of it.
Yes, it was.
But very action packed.
Yeah, it's very dense. Like we said, it was even the slow start to the chapter with last episode when everyone was under that confusion. You know, once you realize what was going on, then it became, it all of a sudden ratcheted that from being slow to, wait a minute, there's a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It moved from 0 to 60 all of a sudden when they realized that something's going on.
Yeah, it's like the captain stomps off to deck, yelling at everybody, and then Kalam comes out on deck, and everybody's getting ready for battle. The storm's rolling in, the sails are getting set, they're tying everything down, and they're turning the ship around, and they land right on top of that pirate ship. It's like boom, boom, boom. It was real quick.
Yeah, so great, man. This crazy stuff there.
Yeah, and then after that very intense battle, the cook coming up and asking Kalam if the meat of the Inkaral tastes good.
Oh, that's too good, man. I agree. That is fantastic. Fantastic. Much needed levity. Thank you, Mr. Erickson.
Yes, yes.
Oh.
And then that cold justice of the fitting end for the treasure.
Yeah, and again, for me, that's a core memory. I can always see this guy going to his watery grave, looking up at the sky going away and taking his last breath. Man, that's nasty. Mm-hmm. That's hard.
That had the feel of when you describe some of those 70s movies where it's like the mechanic or any of the Death Wish type stuff. Just that cold-blooded.
Just cold-blooded murder. It's just like, that's a cold-blooded murder slash execution, whatever you want to call it. It's just cold-blooded.
Mm. Mm. Hebrick telling Felicin that you can't force someone to have faith. You can only make them obey. That was a pretty insightful thing there.
Yes, very insightful. Nicely stated again. Beautifully said.
Yeah. Mm. And then finally, the little thing that Kalam pulled on Sulky Land, making him think he was, for a split second, that he wasn't alone. That was pretty
good. That's good, dude. That's really good. I love that because who knows? Salt may have thought he saw that, but at the same time, I think he may be right. I better start looking over my shoulder.
Right. Definitely pays to be wary, especially in this line of work.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Great job tonight, Billy.
Yeah, great episode, man.
Yeah. You got any final thoughts before we drop off here?
Just a great chapter. So Kalama-centric. So Kalama-licious. Kalama-lific chapter. I just love it. I know you're such a Kalam lover. I know him to be one of your all-time faves. And so I know you had to really enjoy this chapter because it was some really serious fighting from him. It's great.
Oh, yeah. The way Erickson describes his fighting style, it's so epic. It'd be great to see it on screen, especially if filmed correctly, not this chopping up the scenes because the actor can't do it right. You know, we're talking John Wick has pushed the bar forward. So you have to have actors that are capable of doing the stuff themselves in many cases. Agreed. You know,
agreed.
Willing agreed. To do it, too. Yeah, so they actually look like they know how to handle weapons.
Yes. I like when they do that. I like when you can tell, because you can tell. You can tell when they're not flinching.
Yeah. What comes to mind is one of the worst cases of this is From Paris with Love with John Travolta. Uh-huh. You could tell that none of the fighting was him because it never showed his face whenever any actual fighting was happening. And it was all real fast cuts and just really – I hate that style of cinematography.
If used okay, part of that is because that's like someone trying to copy him in Swordfish and make, you know, that's kind of what that was, real cut, you know, in that one. But I can't remember anything about that movie.
Swordfish?
No.
From Paris with Love?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember at one point he had a rocket launcher and he shot it at a car, maybe.
Okay. I can remember him being shaved. He's shaved bald. Yeah, shot. That's
was
all
the
I can
first
remember.
Time I ever saw him with a shaved head.
It doesn't look good on him.
No. He doesn't wear it as well as you and I, that's for sure.
Please. No one, sir, wears it as well as you and I.
some of us are blessed with a nicely shaped skull.
Hey, you know the saying, right?
What's that?
The Lord created only so few perfect heads. The rest he covered with hair.
Oh, that's good.
So, there you go.
All right. On that note, we end. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
See y'all next week.
We thank you all for joining us today.
Again, we'd really like to thank you for taking the time to be with us, and we've had a really great time talking about the topic today.
If you would like to support our show, you can find us at horsefrogproductions.com, where you can find our Patreon link. Depending on the platform you're listening from, it may also be in the episode description.
And if you'd like to contact us through email, it's at contact@horsefrogproductions.com.